Our Tau Hartman University book review of the day is Richard Belzer's new book, Corporate Conspiracies, How Wall Street Took Over Washington. This is from the introduction. Of all the books we researched for this work, the title we loved the most was this one, Regime Change Begins at Home, Freeing America from Corporate Rule. We loved it because it presents as a hard fact something that very few people completely understand. And then he quotes from that book. Since 1980, America has been run by a corporate regime that has co-opted both political parties and shifted sovereignty from we the people to transnational corporations, end of quote. Since this book covers some corporate conspiracies, we will no doubt take a lot of heat for that and be deridingly referred to as conspiracy theorists. So we would just like to remind people that the phrase conspiracy theorist was actually invented by the Central Intelligence Agency, be used as a weaponized term with which to discourage people from seeking the truth. We kid you not. CIA document 1035-960, dated April 1, 1967, regarding the agency's concern about the reputation of the American government, in quotes. That document also suggested various tactics for countering, quote, conspiratorial arguments, which confronted the gaping holes critics observed in the findings of the Warren Commission, which investigated, in quotes, they really did no such thing in reality, the assassination of President Kennedy. Quote, the agency also directed its members to employ propaganda assets to negate and refute the attacks of the critics, end quote. So as you can see, and as the Freedom of Information Act release, so that CIA document clearly reveals, the use of the term conspiracy theorist is actually a conspiracy itself. But if you believe rightly that Julius Caesar and hundreds of other leaders were the victims of conspirators, as they were, then you're an evil conspiracy theorist, right? Well, if anybody actually believes that, then you'd better read up on your history, boys and girls, because conspiracies are an ongoing and very common occurrence in human conduct. Now let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Are you aware that many friends of Robin Williams believe that his suicide was the direct result of the prescription drugs he was taking? And that over 23,000 suicides are attributed to psychiatric drugs each year in the United States? Did you know that turning prisons into a big business has resulted in the United States having the highest incarceration rate in the history of the world, and the most are just drug crimes? Are you aware that the historic event of the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Iraq was actually a U.S. military PSYOPs, psychological operations warfare, program, a completely orchestrated event with the knowledge and assistance of U.S. media and not a spontaneous event as it was portrayed by our media? Did you know that the Pentagon is sending $1.5 trillion of our tax dollars to their corporate buddies for a new fighter jet that's already superfluous? Are you aware that continuing to rely on oil instead of investing in low-carbon energy solutions will cost us $44 trillion due to climate change? Did you know that companies like General Motors at times know that their products will kill people, but they do nothing because it's actually cheaper to compensate the victims than it is to correct the problem? Then read and learn on, friends. American corporations have been getting away with murder, literally, for many, many years. Just take a good look at their history. The above example of GM is a proven point. Consumer advocate Clarence Ditlow, executive director of the nonprofit Center for Automotive Safety, bitterly criticized the settlement, quote, GM killed over 100 people by knowingly putting a defective ignition switch into over 1 million vehicles, Ditlow said. Today, thanks to its lobbyists, GM officials walk off scot-free while its customers are 6 feet under. Tobacco companies knowingly lied about the harmful effects of cigarettes for decades, even though there was plenty of known medical proof of their damage. They even knowingly hid that information from the public. Oil, gas, and chemical companies have been knowingly polluting our planet with cancer-causing chemicals and products for decades, and they know that they're doing it. Pharmaceutical companies have lied and attempted to minimize news coverage regarding the deaths that they know the drugs will cause. That's murder, plain and simple. Maybe you can paint a public relations damage control over that landscape if you happen to have all their tons of money and paid political influence, but it's still murder. Look at the parents of one of their victims straight in the eye and try and tell them it's not murder. Do you honestly think they'll listen to you? This book is an effort to reveal the insanity of corporate greed once and for all. At this point, most people probably care more about their local football team than they do about the workings of our democratic republic. And while we understand their frustration and their reasons, that's not good enough, folks. We have to all get involved to stop these bastards from getting away with what they've been getting away with for far too long. They're robbing us blind, poisoning our planet, hijacking our democracy, and ruining the futures of our children and grandchildren. They must be stopped. As an agent of the U.S. government employed to implement policies to benefit U.S. corporations, John Perkins noted in his classic work, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that corporate America has extended its rule beyond our borders. Quoting from Perkins, what we had previously considered U.S. corporations were now truly international, even from a legal standpoint. Many of them were incorporated in a multitude of countries. They could pick and choose from an assortment of rules and regulations under which to conduct their activities, and the multitude of globalizing trade agreements and organizations made this even easier. Corporatocracy had become a fact, and it increasingly exerted itself as the single major influence on world economics and politics. Sad to make this observation, but we have become a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. That's Richard Belzer's new book, Corporate Conspiracies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the cluelessness of so many people in the media rolls on. I was gratified to see about a half a dozen people yesterday on Twitter were tweeting about the two Santa Claus theory. But the media just doesn't get it. And neither do most Democrats, which is frankly astonishing to me because there's not at least a senior Republican. I mean, you might have, you know, people who've served a couple of terms in the House of Representatives, or they just showed up recently who didn't get the memo, as it were. But the memo was published in the Wall Street Journal back in the 1970s by June Wininski. When Republicans are in office, run up the debt as high as you can. And then when Democrats come into office, and this is why they just did a two-year budget deal that was voted on this morning, because it's going to expire in 2019, which, surprise, surprise, is right after it's possible that a Democratic House or a Democratic Senate will have been sworn in. So when Democrats are in power, scream about the debt. Oh, my God, the debt. It's going to kill our children. It's going to, every household in America owes $170,000. Oh, it's a, you know, all hysteria, all unnecessary, all BS, but this is their thing. Scream about the debt when a Democrat is in Congress. So as Jude Wininski counseled the Republicans, you can force the Democrats to shoot their Santa Claus. And it's happened twice with the last two Democrats. Bill Clinton declaring the era of big government is over and welfare as we know it is dead, right? Number one. And number two, Barack Obama. Hey, let's have a chain CPI. Let's cut Social Security. This is exactly what the Republicans want Democrats to do. Jude Wininski pointed out back in 1974 in the Wall Street Journal. And of course, he was a big Republican. He participated in the creation of things like the Heritage Foundation. I mean, this guy was huge. Ed Crane at Cato, you know, wrote a eulogy for him that was just effusive. When he died, I think it was in 2005, Jude Wininski said, the Democrats have always been the party of Santa Claus. Democrats gave America free college education, free public education, public schools. That was a Democratic idea. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, fought by the Republicans tooth and nail back in the 1930s, a Democratic idea. Protection of our food and our drugs and our environment, Democratic ideas. Yes, the EPA was passed under Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon tried to veto it. Republicans hated it. But Democrats controlled the House of Representatives back then, and I think for a little while in there, they controlled the Senate. You name it, right? Outside of the federal highway system, which Eisenhower did over the objection of many of his Republicans, not all, because back then, back in the 1950s, you had a lot of Republicans who thought, hey, the New Deal wasn't such a bad idea. It got us out of the Depression. But the simple thing that Jude Wininski pointed out was that the Republicans have always been viewed as the party of Scrooge. They opposed every single one of those things. And Wininski said, in the Wall Street Journal in the 70s, he said, if the Republican Party is going to survive long term, we have to become a Santa Claus party. You know, history shows, FDR taught us, that parties that give people to the things to the people, things that the people actually want and need, parties who fulfill the constitutional mandate, which is in the preamble to the Constitution, in the opening to Article 1, Section 8, which defines how Congress can appropriate and spend money, and in the end of Article 1, Section 8, parties who serve the common good, parties who fund the common good, parties who expand the general welfare is the phrase in the Constitution, parties that expand the general welfare, the good of the people through the commons. Those parties win elections over and over and over again. Those parties took over all of Western Europe. They took over, much of Central and South America, at least for a while, until the billionaires rose up and funded right-wing coups and things. And so, Wininsky said, the Republicans have to become a Santa Claus party, too. So how do you do it? How do you become Santa Claus if you hate giving people giving things to people? Well, the obvious answer was become the party of tax cuts. But, Barry Goldwater said, if you cut taxes, and back then, keep in mind, the top income tax rate was 91%. 91%. And the corporate tax was, the corporations were paying almost a third of all the cost of the federal government right now, or back then. Right now, they're paying about 11%. And that's going to go radically down now with the GOP tax scam. So keep in mind, back then, taxes were really high, but Barry Goldwater and others in the Republican Party said, but wait a minute, if you become the party of tax cuts, you're going to run up the debt. And that's not a Republican thing to do. That's not a conservative thing to do. We believe in fiscal sanity. And Jude Wininsky said, it doesn't matter. You can be fiscally sane when you have power, but right now, your guys are out of power. It was 1974. Richard Nixon resigned in August of that year. The prospect for the party, I mean, people all across America, Republican consultants, were convinced that the Republican Party was going to go the way of the Whigs. There was even talk about inventing a new party. Third parties were coming out. Liberty Party, the Libertarian Party, there was a bunch of them. And the big question in 74 was, what's going to replace the Republicans? They're doomed. They're screwed. And Wininsky said, no. This is easy. Don't worry about those debts. Don't worry about those deficits, because when Republicans are in charge, you run the debt up as hard and as high as you can, as fast as you can, because you're not going to be in power forever. And then once the Democrats win, which they do, we have a system that goes back and forth, more or less every 8 to 12 years. When Democrats come into power, then you scream about the deficit. Then, oh, my God, our kids are, and all that kind of stuff. And proclaim, as Paul Ryan did yesterday, as Rand Paul did last night in the Senate, proclaim loudly, the only solution to this deficit problem is to cut spending, which is a euphemism for, it's now time to dial back Medicare, dial back Medicaid. In fact, if we can, kill the damn programs off altogether. Do away with welfare. Do away with aid to dependent children. Do away with educational programs. Do away with, any possibility that we're ever going to support free college education. In fact, cut back on public education to push people into for-profit charter schools, because our billionaires are well invested in them and they want a return on their damn investment. And thus, the Republican Party becomes the Santa Claus tax cut, the Santa Claus of tax cuts. The added benefit, Wininsky pointed out, and Reagan proved, is that if you triple the national debt, as Reagan did in his 8 years, and spend that money, he gave about half of it to his billionaire buddies. Keep in mind, when Reagan came into office, the top tax rate was 74%. He dropped it down to 25%. By the time he left, it was around 30%, as I recall. It went back up again a little bit. But it's been below 50% since Reagan. And whenever the top tax rate is below 50%, what you get is massive inequality in the economy. The rich get richer and richer and richer. And 100% of all new, of the principal gains from our economic growth, all new growth, has accrued to the top 10% of Americans. And of that, about 80% of it went to the top 1%. This is the result of cutting taxes. So, you know, the Republicans are simply following their game plan. They're being Santa Claus. But here we have Paul Krugman, fraudulence of the fiscal hawks. Like he's gonna rub it in their face. Paul Ryan used to be a budget hawk, a deficit hawk. Now he's okay with this giant deficits. Alan Rappaport writing in the New York Times, the headline, Republicans learn to love deficit spending they once loathed. No, they loved it during Reagan, they loved it during Bush, and they love it now during Trump. They only hate it when a Democrat's in office. Here's another one. Oh, this is the Financial Times. They're all over the place. These guys are clueless. Somebody tell them. It's the two Santa Claus theory.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jude Wininski lives. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back. Your calls on any topic you'd like. Stick around. And welcome back. Steve in Lexington Park, Maryland. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. First one up today. How do you like that?
There you go.
I tried to call you the other day about the worst president ever survey that you were doing, and mm-hmm. I wanted to, in my mind, yes, Ronald Reagan is the number one, followed by 1A, the first Bush, 1B, the second Bush, and 1C, the current president that we unfortunately have. Also, I wanted to ask you, have you ever read a book called Worst Period, President Period Ever, period, by Robert Strauss? It tells about James Buchanan as the worst president.
Oh, really?
And
I don't know
yeah.
a lot about Buchanan.
Okay, well, back in his days,
What years were Buchanan? When was Buchanan president?
He was the 15th president.
So it was the 1830s. He followed Taylor.
Well, he was the 15th president, and I believe Abraham Lincoln was the following him as the 16th president.
Oh, okay. So he was between Polk and Lincoln.
I believe so, if I'm looking. But back in those days, Buchanan was probably the most qualified person to be president because he had experience on the state level in politics. He had a lot of experience on the federal level, being in the legislation. He was in the cabinet, and he was probably the most qualified. But, you know, when he came in, he sympathized with the southern states, and that was his downfall. And of course, he had that Dred Scott decision by the if I'm correct, by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that was 1856. So that would have been between Polk and Lincoln. Yeah,
right. And that didn't help him. So if you ever get a chance, try to read that Worst President Ever book by Robert Strauss, because besides talking about why he was the worst, you learned a lot about the history of the country during that time.
That sounds fascinating.
All right. Well, I appreciate being on today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for contributing to that, Steve. I appreciate it. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Anthony.
Okay.
Oops. Excuse me. Anthony in Utica, Michigan. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, listen, Tom. It's an honor.
Thank you.
It's an honor to talk with you. I've been a listener for many years, and I finally have a chance to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Anthony. We just have a minute, so let's get right to it.
I have the highest respect for you. Listen, I have something to hold you accountable for. I think last week you made a comment about Ulysses S. Grant being an incompetent alcoholic, or, you know, he was.
No, I didn't say he was incompetent, but he was drunk a lot.
Okay. Read the book by Ron Chernoff called Grant. It's a 900-page book.
I have a copy of it. It's in our storage along with another 3,000 of my books that eventually is going to migrate back to our house. But I haven't read it. I'm sorry. What?
All right. The bottom line is he was misconceived about his reputation. He was not under the influence of alcohol during his administration or even after that. And read the book. It goes into a great deal about that, and you will be impressed.
Oh, interesting.
By his character.
But the popular mythology is that he was an alcoholic, isn't it?
That's the popular, especially by his enemies. Read the book.
I know he wrote. He wrote, some amazing kind of history stuff. I mean, he was a prolific writer. Or diarist or whatever it was. But I don't know that much about Grant. I'll have to look it up. Anthony, thanks for the heads up on that. It sounds like a fascinating book. I look forward to it. We'll be right back. It is 20 minutes past the hour.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America.
Sister Helen Prejean in May of 2000.
We are now incarcerating 2 million human beings. We are building more and more walls. We're throwing more and more people behind the walls. The whole thing of believing that human beings can change, that they can be restored. Some people say, well, you know that whole thing of rehabilitation. Well, we tried that and it didn't work. We never tried that. We don't even have habilitation of human beings before they get to prison.
Sister Helen Prejean in May of 2000.
Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives' mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday. You heard my rant on two Santa Clauses, and thank you all for those of you who have been trying to propagate this and tweet it to specific members of Congress and inform them about it. I'm writing up an article about this. Got started this morning about 6 a.m. and hope to have it finished by the end of the day. I'll get it off to Jan at Alternet, and hopefully it'll go up tomorrow or Sunday. So check it out. But you know, to give you more ammunition. But if you Google two Santa Clauses and my name, you'll come up with an old article that I wrote in 2009. On Common Dreams about it, or a piece that I wrote that, for some reason, Google does not put Alternet stories up. I guess Alternet has been critical of Google or something. They're blacklisted as fake news, I know, but they're not fake news. I mean, it's one of the best sites out there. I love Alternet. But Salon, which has a relationship with Alternet, also picked up a piece. If you that will also show up on the, you know, which I wrote a few years ago. So anyhow, back to your calls. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Yeah, no problem. The but he a little bit.
Dave, your phone is breaking up terribly. Can you quickly move to a position where I can, where it'll work, or shall I put you on hold and you and Arthur can work it out?
Put me on hold.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, Dave, but you know, I was losing every other word. He's on line six, Arthur, if you can check it out, and he can figure out where he can go, where we can actually hear him. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
I'm going to give a shout-out. San Francisco's grabbing they're going to form a task force for a public bank, if anybody's in San Francisco, on the 21st City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just...
Is this for statewide, or are you talking about a Citibank?
Just city.
Oh, wow.
City. And they have $10 billion in their, portfolio.
Right.
And they're getting about 0.97%.
Well, that's terrible. The bank's got to take a profit, right? But if they had a Citibank, then all of that profit, instead of going to New York banksters, would be going to the city of San Francisco.
Well, if they could give students with student loan debt, say, point and a half, 1.5, they'd be doubling their money almost.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then it would be helping the community and then be building up capital. And
yep.
I think their fees are about $3 million a year at least. So,
if they have $10 billion portfolio, it's got to be more than that.
Oh, you think so?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's the obvious fees, but then basically any kind of investment transactions that go on, there are all kinds of hidden fees in those things.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to invade the task force. I don't know if it's open to the public, but I'm pushing hard to try to get in there. Maybe I'll get a fake pass, press pass or something.
No, don't, you shouldn't have to use subterfuge. I would suggest if you want to, you know, be an activist in any city, I mean, you're in San Francisco, but at the city level, that you start building coalitions with members of the city council who think the same way you do. You know, go to their office, say, you know, how can I help you run for re-election? How can I support you? And by the way, I've got some things I'd like to say. And actually, you know, show up and help out. And what you'll find is that, I mean, it sounds kind of crass, but one hand washes the other. You know, if you help them out, they'll help. They'll be more inclined to help you out.
Yeah.
What you say.
Well,
it's basically what lobbyists do, you know.
Mayor. So, yeah, there's a new mayor up, London Breed. I might try to go talk to her. She'll bring things up.
Or start with her staffers. Start with the staff and particularly the campaign staff, and get yourself on their radar screen, and you'll find it's not that hard then to work your way up. If you just start right at the top, they'll block you. You know, they won't know who you are.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate the advice. And anybody in San Francisco, look this up. It was in the Examiner on February 4th, an article by Josh Sabatini announced it. And so I'm trying to get there and see what's happening.
Okay.
So, well, I think it's a great idea.
Well, good luck, Jeff. I wish you the very best. Let's see here. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm actually in the Snoqualmie Pass. I always lose signal going over the mountain pass.
Okay.
Sorry. Hey, but my question was, I wanted to say Rand Paul did talk a little bit about the two Santa Claus theory. I mean, he didn't say it specifically, but, I mean, I'm not a fan of Rand Paul, but he did kind of allude to it. He said that they shouldn't criticize Obama. Republicans shouldn't criticize Obama and then for raising the deficit, but be okay with it under a Republican administration.
Oh, interesting.
And
so he doesn't know Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan know this inside out, and as did, you know, Reagan and Bush. Whether Trump was told or not, I don't know, but I'm guessing he has been. But that's interesting.
Yep. Hey, and I wanted to get your opinion on something. An economist the other day said, now I just caught a snippet of it, and I'm kind of passionate about wages. Yeah, real quick. He said that the inflation, the stock market is going through fluctuations because of broad wage increases.
Right.
And what I'm worried about is, do you think the Republicans are going to use this to roll back all the wage increases they've given?
They don't have to. What happens is, as interest rates go up, the economy tightens and wages go down automatically. This is why back in 1980, Alan Greenspan said to the Wall Street Journal that his most important job was preventing wage inflation by increasing interest rates.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And when working people get increases in their wages, people like Greenspan call it wage inflation. When billionaires get increases, nah, it's just fine. No big deal. And welcome back to the Tom Hartman University Book Club. Today we're reading from The Last Hours of Humanity. Warming the World to Extinction, a book about extinction. The climate scientists' warnings have come true. There is more carbon in our atmosphere, trapping heat and moisture, than ever before in the 165,000-year history of the human race. We are on the verge of the first ice-free summer in the Arctic in 3 million years. And back then, the Earth was a very different place from the one currently cradling us. The consequences of a warming planet are appearing much faster than had been projected by climate scientists of just a decade ago. The most dire warnings, rising oceans, freak storms, and agricultural collapse, they're all taking place right now. And it's going to get worse. But now other voices have entered the fray. Those of geologists who study the longer-term implications and histories of a planet undergoing rapid global warming. Specifically, they are focused on extinctions. The climate scientists, geologists, and those from related scientific disciplines need to continue talking to each other, because at some point we may be able to see the critical moment in which the current climate crosses from the realm of a global destabilizer to a global extinction event. We must wake up. It's hard to imagine life without Earth. We take the vast variety of life on this planet, and even our own existence, for granted. But numerous times in our planet's history, life as we know it has come close to it disappearing entirely. We call these events mass extinctions, and we even teach school children about those times of great death on our planet. For example, we know that long ago, on a much more unstable planet, the dinosaurs were killed by an asteroid striking the Earth. This leads many people to believe that as long as we don't see an asteroid hurtling toward the planet, all is well. But this is not rational thinking for several reasons. The asteroid impact that killed the dinosaurs and started a major mass extinction is the only event having to do with outer space that we can trace with any certainty. And new science indicates that the asteroid impact itself wasn't what killed the dinosaurs. It was the global warming that followed it. New science has discovered a common theme in all of the extinctions in the past, and it's woven right into the global fabric of today as yet another mass extinction threatens our planet. That global consistent thread is global warming. We have had six extinctions in the billion-year history of life on our planet. Each sharp spike in the chart below indicates one of these mass extinctions. And there's a chart on the page. Occurring about 450 million years ago, the Ordovician slash Silurian mass extinction devastated marine life, which at the time dominated the planet. In a series of two extinctions, 60 and 70% of all life on the planet was taken, respectively. Then, fewer than 100 million years later, the planet was rocked again. The Dinovian period was capped off by a 20-million-year death march. It killed off 70% of life on Earth. This included many coral reefs, which didn't return for another 100 million years. We know of the KT extinction, the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction, which occurred 65 million years ago, ending the reign of the dinosaurs. There was also an extinction event 200 million years ago, known as the Triassic-Jurassic mass extinction. But none of these extinctions explains the huge spike shown in the center of the previous chart. That one happened 250 million years ago and was the worst mass extinction of species event in the history of our planet. It was the extinction of all extinctions, referred to as the Great Dying. The Permian mass extinction took out at least 95% of all life on the planet in fewer than 100,000 years, an instant in geological time. Professor Paul Wignall of the University of Leeds and an expert on mass extinctions told me that the Permian was the greatest crisis that life on Earth has ever suffered. Only in the past two decades has the cause of the Permian extinction been understood. It was speculated that an asteroid impact may have been the trigger, but more recent research by Professor Wignall, geologists, and other scientists around the world have revealed the true trigger came from deep within the Earth. The Permian mass extinction was initiated by a colossal flow of lava in an area of what is now Siberia. That was the trigger, but not the killer. The killer was under the water and under the ice, where trillions of tons of greenhouse gases, largely derived from carbon, and frozen in the form of crystalline methane, lay in wait. Thus, global warming is the force behind the death of nearly everything on the planet during the Permian mass extinction. That point is well illustrated. You can again see the spikes of mass extinctions measured by the increase in global temperatures, with the largest spike representing the Permian mass extinction. Wignall told me, there have been a lot of disasters and crises in the geological past. It's interesting to study them because they may have a comparison to today. He added, I think it is certainly extremely significant that a lot of the main crises of the past are associated with global warming, with obvious implications for the present day. The sixth mass extinction may even rival the speed and intensity of the Great Permian mass extinction, but the sixth is not represented on either of the two previous charts. That's because it's the one happening today, right now, all around us. And then we go on to document how the burning of fossil fuels is throwing an amount of carbon into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that's relatively similar to what happened with that giant volcanic eruption in Siberia 250 million years ago with the Permian mass extinction, and how it could be leading to a major extinction event. The book is The Last Hours of Humanity, Warming the World to Extinction.
Learn all about the Tom Hartmann Podcast at tomhartmann.com/podcast. They're commercial free, and you can listen anytime, any place you want.
So the American Humanist Association is promoting Darwin Day resolutions. Monday is Darwin Day. And there are resolutions in both the House and Senate. In the House, it's resolution H Resolution 699. And in the Senate, it's Senate Resolution 374. The work of Congressman Jim Hines and Senator Richard Blumenthal, respectively. And these resolutions say that evolution provides humanity with a logical and intellectually compelling explanation for the diversity of life on Earth, and that the advancement of science must be protected from those unconcerned with the adverse impacts of global warming and climate change, and that teaching of creationism in some public schools compromises the scientific and academic integrity of the United States education systems. So if you want to sign the petition or ask your representative or senator to co-sponsor the Darwin Day resolutions, you can go over to, what is this, humanist.org, I think. Let's see. Oh, this is weird. On their entire email, they don't have their own website. Well, Google American Humanist Association or DuckDuckGo it, and you'll track it down. And broadband, community broadband. We're trying to make community broadband happen here in Portland, Oregon. We'll have a guest on about that at the top of the next hour. So just an FYI. John in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Hey, John, it's Anything Goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, Tom, my question is about the possible prosecution of the entire Republican Party. I actually call them the Republicans, because I think the RICO Act was originally against organized crime, targeted mostly at the mob.
Yes.
And that party seems to be acting in a criminal way as a group. I was wondering if that can be done and who has to do it.
I believe that the RICO Act requires federal prosecution, but I could be wrong on that. It may be that state prosecutors can bring RICO Act charges. The RICO Act, RICO, stands for Racketeering Influenced Corrupt Organizations. And you're right, it's a law that was passed, as I recall, back in the 60s, when we started learning about the mafia. J. Edgar Hoover had been hiding denying the existence of the mafia right up until the Kennedy presidency. And in fact, when the year before, the last year of the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, there were 17 prosecutions of organized crime in the United States. And by the end of the first year of the Kennedy administration, under the aggressive actions of Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, there were over 700 prosecutions of organized crime, which is, of course, why the mob decided that they had to take out Jack, which they did. And right after that, the prosecutions of the mob started dropping again precipitously under Lyndon Johnson. But it never went back to where it was, because by that point in time, J. Edgar Hoover, who had been being blackmailed by Santos Trafficante for decades about being gay, his whole relationship with Clyde Tolson and everything else, J. Edgar Hoover could just no longer claim that there was no such thing as the mob. So when the RICO Act was passed, it was very tightly targeted, not just at the mob in general, but at the Italian mob specifically, the mafia. And some parts of the language of the RICO Act make it far more difficult to deal with an above-ground organization like the Republican Party, because it was really designed to work against an organization whose existence is, if not denied, at least largely invisible. And so, you know, large chunks of it are useful for that kind of thing. What the Republican Party is doing, they're doing mostly out in the open. But I don't disagree with you, John, or I do agree with you, with those qualifications, which is why I said I don't disagree, qualified agreement. And I've said for many years, I think that the RICO Act, needs to be updated so that it can be used against things like the big banks that conspire with drug money laundering and terrorist money laundering. HSBC got nailed for that. Other big banks in the United States have been prosecuted for that. Wells Fargo was just recently prosecuted for, you know, major fraud. Of course, nobody went to jail. No bankster, you know, has gone to jail decades, or at least a decade. And, you know, we need an updated RICO Act, and we need one that would be broad enough to cover crimes by banksters, crimes by big corporations, you know, trying to conceal how their pesticides kill people or kill bees, that their drugs are killing people. You know, I mean, there's so much corporate crime and fraud going on, and so much of it should fall under the RICO Act and doesn't. And the RICO Act, you know, provides for, you know, radically larger penalties and damages and imprisonment terms if you're prosecuted as basically organized crime. So, I'm totally up with it. That's fine. John, thank you for the call. A great suggestion. Maggie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Maggie, what's up?
It's Margie.
Oh, Margie, hey, I'm sorry. I'm wearing contacts today. It's a little harder to read.
You'll recall that then-Governor Mike Pence sold the Indiana toll road to a group of foreign investors.
Right, principally from Australia and Spain, yes.
Yeah, then eventually they went bankrupt, and I'm not even sure who owns it right now. Well, today there is a major winter storm in Indiana, Illinois. The toll road, which of course is owned by foreign investors, is completely snow-covered. Parts of it are shut down and are being detoured to the interstate highway, which, lo and behold, has at least two of three lanes completely clear,
right,
and is moving and running. Our public infrastructure does not belong in the hands of foreign investors or any private for-profit entity.
Amen, Selah. Yes. you nailed it, Margie, and that is a great example. That is an absolutely great example. I did not know that was the case, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you own a toll road and you're running it for profit and you get a snowstorm and you know in a day or two it's probably going to melt, then why bother shoveling it, you know? Why spend all that money? Whereas if you're a government and your obligation is to the public welfare, the general welfare, and therefore, you know, you need to make sure that people are safe and that they can get to work and things like that, then you plow the roads no matter what. And,
right.
You know, what a classic example. Margie, thank you.
I mean, the state.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Tom. The states are doing what is called conga lines, which is they take a bunch of snow plows, they stagger them one after the other across the lanes, and they do the entire highway.
Yeah.
At once.
Oh yeah, I grew up in Michigan. I mean, they've been doing that forever.
Yeah, you will never see that on a private for-profit road.
Right, because they want just one driver to deal with the whole thing and, you know, cut it to the bone. That's the mandate of the for-profit everything, basically. And, you know, because you got to jack up the profits. The CEO, who is the, you know, of the company that owns the Indiana Toll Road, has to make his multi-million-dollar salary, and his senior executives have to make their million-dollar salaries, and the stockholders have to have their dividends. And all that means that, hey, you know, a little snow, tough luck, Charlie. Margie, thank you for the call. Very well said. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. David in Columbus, Ohio, listening on WGRN. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi. I have an ongoing battle with the Republicans because they never mention cutting the defense budget. In any of the literature they give me for fundraising, it's all about DACA and other things, which are important. But this is what's killing domestic budget. It kills it. It just, they take all of our money, give it to defense contractors, then there's nothing left, and then they scream, oh, there's a horrible deficit. So we need to find out. There used to be a program called America's Defense Monitor, which analyzed all these projects in an objective way and gave us a good understanding of what our money was being spent for. We don't have that on any level. We don't have that from the Democrats, and I would call for either you or somebody to bring back that kind of analysis, and it's detailed and it takes a long time, but I think even a cursory examination of certain projects would be worthwhile.
You know, in many of the European countries, I know I'm for sure it's in Norway, Michael Moore talked about it in his movie Where to Invade Next, or I believe it was Norway, might have been Sweden. Anyhow, it was one of the Scandinavian countries. But it's not confined to just one country. When you get your tax statement at the end of the year, A, not only has their equivalent of the IRS already calculated your taxes, so you don't have to hire anybody and you don't have to do any math unless you want to challenge the government's assertion of what you owe. So you simply sign the form and mail it back. But number two, and perhaps more interestingly, they break out the top 15 or 20 categories of where your money went. So they'll say you paid this year $1,322 in federal taxes. Of that, $516 went to defense, although if it was Norway, it'd be more like $90 went to defense. But here in the United States, it would be, you know, well, actually, it would be more than half. It would be, you know, $750 went to defense, $35 went to pay for people in need, $110 went to support roads, bridges, whatever, you know, and $90 went for education. They just basically break it out so you know where your tax dollars went.
Right.
And the billionaires who control the Republican Party do not want to make taxes easy because they hate taxes. They don't want to be paying taxes. And so they want there to be a taxpayer revolt. In fact, they've funded for years organizations that have you know, the phrase taxpayer revolt either in their name or as part of their mission statement. And you know, they want to make it confusing. They want to make it difficult. They don't want you to have a good experience with the IRS. And I don't think it should just be the Democrats doing this. I think that I would love to see legislation that requires the IRS, because it wouldn't be particularly difficult or expensive. I mean, once they've got the formula, once they know what the percentages of everything are, then their computers would simply apply that to whatever you pay in taxes. So whether you paid $1,270 or $5,916, you know, the percentages are going to be the same. So it'd be super easy to calculate the numbers and tell everybody exactly what they spent on everything. And I think that would cause people to start paying attention to things like these budgets. David, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of Anything Goes Friday after this. And welcome back. John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. John, it says here you listen to our podcast, but our podcasts aren't live. How are you listening right now?
I'm listening on a headset on the phone, listening to you.
Oh, okay. So you, so
I'm driving down. I'm driving an 18-wheeler down the road right now.
I see. Okay. By the way, if you have SiriusXM, we're on SiriusXM too. But anyhow, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, listen. I love the show, and I love the work that you do for us, and thank you for that.
Thank you, John.
What's on my mind right now is I'm really excited about a lot of different things that are going on right now. I'm the same age you are, Tom. I was born in 51. And I remember when an 18-year-old couldn't vote in this country, but he could go and die for our country.
Oh, yeah.
And we the people didn't like that. And we changed that pretty quick.
Yeah. In fact, it was less than a year from the time that amendment was introduced until the time. In fact, I think it was less than 4 months from the time it was introduced until the time it had been ratified.
Right. We didn't like the way that people were being treated in this country with regard to civil rights. And we the people woke up and we changed that.
Yep. Although arguably that took 200 years, but yeah.
Yeah, it took a while. You know, we didn't like the way the gays were treated in this country.
Yes.
We changed that.
Yeah, and that took centuries too.
Yeah, the you know, people want marijuana legalized. It's changing. It's slowly changing, but I see it.
Yeah.
And I'm excited because there are tons and tons of progressive movements right now that are waking up and starting to demand change. And we can beat money. Money is omnipresent. Money never sleeps. Money always fights us. But they never win when we, the people, wake up and we fight back.
Yeah.
And so what I'd like to say, the main reason that I wanted to call was, a lot of people are saying, you know, well, you know, it doesn't really matter what I do. You know, they have a lot of, you know, the Democratic Party is famous, the Republican Party and all that kind of thing. The only viable vehicle right now that we have available to us that would institute immediate change is the Democratic Party. So let's grab the party, pull it to the left. We may lose some of the conservative Democrats currently right now, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. We're going to gain so many more different senators and congressmen.
Oh, I agree, John. You know, Joe Manchin is fighting for his life in West Virginia right now. And if he had been a Bernie Democrat, Bernie won West Virginia by 21 points. If Joe Manchin was, instead of being a conservative Dem, a corporate Dem, which makes sense. I mean, he's been funded by big coal all his life. His daughter, Heather Bresch, runs Mylan Pharmaceuticals, which jacked up the EpiPen price and manufactures their drugs in Hyderabad, India, and imports them into the United States. But you can't buy drugs over state lines, right, or over federal lines. You know, if Joe Manchin had been a Bernie Sanders Democrat, he would be breezing to victory right now. But he also wouldn't probably be as wealthy as he is. Anyhow, back to you, John.
Absolutely. One other quick little thing, okay? If everybody that's listening to this podcast not only, you know, talks about voting and this, that, and the other, but honestly asks their friends, did you vote? And because you'd be surprised, Tom, how many people, they have a political view and they'll talk the talk. But if you ask them whether or not they did or did not vote, well, you know, I was too busy or this came up or that came up.
Oh, it's like, you know, something like between 70 and 80% of millennials don't vote. Is something like between 70 and 60% of Gen Xers and Gen Yers don't vote, and more than half of baby boomers don't vote. I mean, it's bizarre.
Right, and if we ask them, we put them on the spot, maybe they will vote.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's incumbent upon us, if we care about our issues, to fight for them and put people on the spot for it.
Well said. Well said. John, thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. It supports our show. I really appreciate that. And we'll be right back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America.
And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre years later. Well, he said, I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind.
Howard Zinn, Virtual Optimism, The Other Side of American History. Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives' mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Let's see. Anything Goes Friday. Chris in Smyrna, Texas. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hi, Tom. It's actually Smyrna, Tennessee.
Oh, Tennessee.
I don't know where
I'm sorry.
Got Texas from.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
it's.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Tom, after so many years of listening to the show and reading your books. And
thank you, Chris.
Hearing you say at the end of every show that it's time to get up, get active, and it's not a spectator sport, I've decided I'm not going to be a spectator anymore, Tom. I am running for the Tennessee State House of Representatives this fall.
Hey, good on you, Chris. What can we do to promote your candidacy?
Well, I do have a website. It's Mayor, M-A-Y-O-R, the number 4, TN.com.
As in Mayor for Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
So your last name, Chris, is Mayor, M-A-Y-O-R?
It is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Facebook, Twitter pages, et cetera.
Yeah.
We're trying to get, we need to get more progressives elected, especially in these red states.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that Tennessee, especially my district, is as red as people think it is. In 2016, the Democratic candidate got spent 15-1 in my district and still pulled 40%.
Wow.
So I think we have a real shot at flipping this and possibly taking back the entire legislature here in Tennessee.
That would
be amazing.
If we
can do it here, we can do it anywhere.
Yeah, I agree. So what's, who are you running against? Has there been a Democratic primary yet?
There has not been a Democratic primary yet. There are no candidates filed that I'm aware of.
Okay. So you're probably going to be the guy.
It's looking that way. Yes, sir.
That's great.
Yes, sir. I've been working with the county party quite a bit.
Right.
And getting things set up. Our incumbent. He's one of those, he called himself Tea Party representative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put his name out on national radio. But the only thing he got passed last session was a resolution commending Nathan Bedford Forrest. So that's
commending what?
Tells you everything. Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan.
You're kidding.
No.
So
please
put his name out, so people can figure out what it is. You know, what is his name?
He's Representative Mike Sparks.
Mike Sparks.
And
his one legislative accomplishment.
Irony.
Sorry?
That was just this last session. He's done a little here and there. He mostly votes party lines. He's there to do what the Republican leaders tell him to do.
But his major legislative accomplishment recently is honoring the guy who founded the Ku Klux Klan. And you,
yes,
Chris
sir.
Mayer, are running against him, and your website is Mayer, M-A-Y-O-R, the number 4, T-N, as in Tennessee, because you're running for the congressional seat there out of Smyrna, Tennessee, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, hopefully we get some traffic to your website, and keep us up to date on it, Chris, would you?
I absolutely will. Thank you so much, Tom.
Feel free to call in. We limit calls to once a week, but feel free to call in every week and let us know how things are going. Fridays are a particularly good day for it because it's anything goes.
Of course.
Okay?
I certainly will. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Very much.
Good luck. Keep us
all
up
right.
to date. Michael in Ferndale, Washington. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you're awesome.
Thank you. You too.
Well, I try to be. So my question is, should progressives redefine freedom / liberty? And if so, what do you think that definition should be? And the reason why I'm asking is because the conservatives have this way of weaving in freedom and liberty into their talking points such that big government, regulation, controlling guns, you name it, everything is against freedom, like anything the Democrats would want to have, like spending, that's against freedom. Higher taxes, that's against freedom. And I'm just kind of like, we need to start pushing them to define, well, what do you mean by freedom, you know?
No, we instead, what we need to do is be defining it for ourselves. Franklin Roosevelt, when he was president, and I believe it was in his State of the Union address, but it might have been in his either 32 or 36 acceptance to the for his nomination, made a rather famous speech in which he defined freedom. And that definition
right.
of freedom stood until the Reagan presidency. Everybody understood it. And he basically, the famous phrase from his speech was, a necessitous man is not a free man. Now, back
exactly.
in the 30s, everybody knew what necessitous means. In fact, it was the state of the country. But it's an anachronistic word now. Most people don't know what it means, so we'd have to restate that. A man who doesn't have housing, or a woman, a person who doesn't have housing, is not free. If you're hungry, you're not free. If you don't have health care, and you get sick or you're concerned about getting sick, you're not free. If your job doesn't pay enough that you can maintain a decent standard of living, you are not free. And FDR explicitly claimed those things. In fact, he, toward the end of his life, proposed, you know, basically his agenda was the four freedoms. Harvey J. Kay, who's a brilliant historian, K-A-Y-E is his last name, wrote a book called The Four Freedoms about this. So I would suggest that, Michael, that the Democratic Party needs to, in a big way, hearken back to FDR, the most successful president in history, and hearken back to FDR and adopt that definition of freedom. What do you think?
No, I mean, I think that's great. I just don't hear that in the context of the media, and
yeah.
I think it needs to come back. 'Cause
I agree.
I don't think anyone's free when they have to work from paycheck to paycheck, and they're just scraping
yep.
by.
Yep, if you're just scraping by, you're not free. Michael, we're hitting
yeah.
a break here. I'm sorry, but thank you. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about community broadband right after this, and then back to your calls.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.